This is Hannah Connor, returning with the Pantograph, dated May 6, 2025. We will continue now with the death notices and funeral notices on page A4. Funerals today for May 6th. Manahan. Wilma B., 104, Bloomington, 10 a.m. at Wiley Cemetery, Colfax, and 1 p.m. at Calvert's and Metzler Memorial Home, Bloomington. Funerals pending for May 6th. Chapman. Margie, 83, died Sunday, May 4th, 2025. Calvert Funeral Home, Clinton. Fenton. David E. Dave, 79, Bloomington, died Sunday, May 4th, 2025. Kibler Brady Rustman, Bloomington. Huffman. Edith C., 94, Clinton, died Saturday, May 3rd, 2025. Calvert Funeral Home, Clinton. McMahon, Marvis Arlene, 93, Clinton, died Friday, May 2nd, 2025, Calvert Funeral Home, Clinton. We now move to the opinions page, beginning with the article titled, "The U.S. Can't Pretend Putin Wants Peace." The White House deserves credit for revitalizing diplomacy to end the war in Ukraine. In its haste for a deal, however, its proposals have too often looked indistinguishable from a surrender on Russia's terms. If the U.S. wants to secure a lasting peace, it will need to put forward a more credible offer and increase the pressure on Russian President Vladimir Putin to accept. American negotiators have offered up a ceasefire plan that would leave Russia in de facto control of almost all Ukrainian territory it now occupies. In addition to land, Putin would win substantial sanctions relief. The U.S. may also formally recognize Crimea, which Russia illegally annexed in 2014. Ukraine would be allowed to maintain its military, but be offered only vague security guarantees to be enforced by an ad hoc coalition of allies, not including the U.S. For at least the duration of the current U.S. administration, it would be barred from joining NATO. Further details would be negotiated after the guns fall silent. Despite such a favorable offer, Putin seems in no hurry to end his invasion, continuing to demand all four Ukrainian regions he only partially controls. For their part, Ukrainian leaders rightly argue they need a clear pledge of continued U.S. military support, air defense systems, help with cybersecurity and intelligence, and a U.S. backstop for any allied peacekeeping troops. The agreement signed recently to give the United States privileged access to Ukraine's mineral resources is no substitute. The White House cannot expect Ukrainians to accept a capitulation they anticipate will lead to a renewed assault. While they have little hope of ejecting Russian forces in the near term, their defenses have been stout. The country now boasts Europe's largest standing army and manufactures many of its own weapons. Its people are weary of war, but not ready to give in. Russia's advantages aren't as decisive as they appear. Over the past 3 years, its troops have advanced slowly and at enormous cost. Its war economy is straining under high inflation, labor shortages, soaring interest rates, and dwindling foreign reserves. After purportedly topping 4% last year, growth has sputtered to around 0%, according to Goldman Sachs Group Inc. Lower oil prices have dented a major source of budget revenue. U.S. officials have implied that they've presented their final offer and are prepared to walk away if the two sides cannot agree. A better strategy would be to make clear the U.S. is willing to provide logistical help to peacekeepers on the ground, continued aid for Ukraine's military and defense industries, and backing for the country's integration into Europe's security architecture and eventual membership in the European Union. Simultaneously, American officials should let the Kremlin know that if it continues to balk, the U.S. will further tighten sanctions, including secondary measures against buyers of Russian oil, and take steps to strengthen Ukraine's ability to defend itself. U.S. military aid and intelligence will flow unimpeded. No matter what deal he signs now, Putin will likely continue to view Ukraine as Russian and Ukrainians' freedom as a threat. To endure, any peace agreement must include a substantive deterrent against future aggression. The U.S. ought to provide it. How to boost kidney donations with $50,000 incentive. For economists, Americans' organ shortage is a perplexing public health problem. About 37 million Americans suffer from kidney disease, and more than 800,000 live with kidney failure. At this advanced stage, patients either receive a kidney transplant or remain on dialysis, an expensive and often debilitating treatment, for the rest of their lives. Of the more than 90,000 Americans placed on the kidney transplant waitlist, only about 1 in 4 in 2024 received a kidney. Simple steps can radically increase the number of kidneys available for transplant, but political and institutional inertia has stood in the way. By changing incentives for prospective donors in transplant centers, we could save thousands of lives every year. The first and best step towards this goal is the passage of the End Kidney Death Act, recently introduced in Congress. It would secure $50,000 in refundable tax credits for living kidney donors who donate to someone they don't know. Historically, advocacy efforts have focused on increasing organ donation by encouraging people to register to be donors after their death. This is a noble cause, but not one that will address our nation's kidney shortage. Fewer than 2% of people die in a way that allows their kidneys to be removed for transplant. Fortunately, we have a better option. The best treatment for end-stage kidney disease is a transplant from a living donor, which can last its recipient up to twice as long as one from deceased sources. Kidney donation is remarkably safe and getting safer. Donors have the same life expectancy as non-donors, and the operation has better outcomes on average than childbirth and appendectomies. What's more, tens of thousands of brave people are willing to donate one of their kidneys to save the life of a loved one or stranger. But only a third of transplanted kidneys come from a living donor. Why is that? One barrier to widespread living donation is a lack of willing donors. Despite the low levels of risk associated with kidney donation, it remains an intensive process with a recovery time that can vary from 4 weeks to several months. Donation can also be expensive. Donors miss weeks of work during the evaluation, donation, and recovery, on top of transportation and caregiving costs. One 2019 paper by university researchers estimated that donors face financial disincentives in the range of $38,000. Programs that nominally reimburse donors for incidental costs are either means-tested against recipients or only offer reimbursement after donation, meaning donors must be able to afford lost wages and other costs upfront. In the United States, it remains illegal to provide donors with any valuable consideration for kidney donation. This not only prohibits financial compensation, but also prevents donors from receiving healthcare coverage. We can bring living organ donation to an all-time high by revisiting the National Organ Transplant Act, which makes compensation for kidney donation illegal. The End Kidney Death Act offers a sensible, moderate approach with refundable tax credits of $50,000 for non-directed living donors. The credit would be paid out over the course of 5 years at $10,000 each year and mirror the support we already extend to other public servants, such as veterans, firefighters, and adoptive parents. If the act passes, the coalition estimates that 100,000 Americans would receive healthy kidneys from living donors over the course of 10 years. Taxpayers would save $10 billion to $37 billion in averted dialysis costs. Meanwhile, such policy would help tackle a persistent disparity, the disproportionate impact of kidney disease on low-income Americans who are significantly less likely to receive a kidney from a loved one. By implementing common sense policy, voters, lawmakers, and medical institutions can team up to radically reduce death and suffering as a result of this devastating disease. Stephen Levitt is an emeritus professor of economics at the University of Chicago and co-author of Freakonomics. He is co-founder of the university's Center for Radical Innovation for Social Change, where Rorty is a senior analyst. They lead Project Donor and wrote this for the Chicago Tribune. Now to sports on page B1. Illinois State Baseball. Takeaways from Illinois State's MVC Baseball Series versus Missouri State by Randy Reinhardt. Normal. Illinois State right-hander Tyrell Chadwick watched Missouri State pile up 14 runs and 15 hits on Friday and still took the mound on Saturday with unwavering confidence. "They've had a lot of success at the plate all year," said Chadwick. "I've had a pretty good year as well. I can go out and bet on myself every day." Chadwick limited the Missouri Valley Conference leading Bears to 2 runs and 5 hits over 7 innings Saturday as the Redbirds took the middle game of a Valley series 7-3 at Duffy Base Field. "Tyrell was fantastic," ISU coach Steve Holmes said. "He kept them off balance and he landed off speed early in the game, which was critical for him. His fastball moves a lot and has a lot of sink." Missouri State prevailed in the series with a 14-10 win Friday and a 4-3 nail-biter Sunday to improve to 25-20 overall and 15-6 in the MVC. ISU slipped to 22-23 and 11-10 in league play. Here's a recap of the weekend series. Sunday. The Redbirds stranded 7 base runners in scoring position and pushed the tying run to third base in the 9th inning before falling. "We had some opportunities there to cash in some runs," said Holm. "Our offense has carried us all year. They've been really good. Right now, we're not necessarily firing on all cylinders. That came back to bite us a little bit today." ISU Kyle Gibson and Shai Robinson led off the first inning with singles, only to see Bears starter Tyler Charlton strike out 3 straight batters. That would become a theme as Charlton fanned 11 and walked 1 in the 4 2/3 innings. Redbird batters finished with 15 strikeouts. "We knew he had strikeout stuff, but we struck out quite a few hitters too," Holmes said. "The strike zone seemed to be a little bit bigger today than it has been, which contributes to pitchers getting a little more aggressive too." Danielle Pacella's 2-run home run, his 16th of the season, and the 3rd with Robinson aboard, tied the score at 2-all. Those RBIs also boosted the junior left fielder into 2nd place on ISU's career list with 169. Missouri State touched ISU starter Tanner Perry for a Zach Stewart solo home runner in 3 runs over 5 innings. Perry struck out 9 and walked 1. The Bears grabbed a 3-2 edge with a run in the 5th and led by 2 after what turned out to be a crucial 9th inning tally. ISU scored once and loaded the bases in the bottom of the 9th, but Missouri State closer Jackson Holmes retired Judah Morris on a foul out to end the game. Robinson reached base on all 5 trips to the plate on 2 singles, 2 walks, and a hit by pitch. Center fielder Luke Stolga extended his hitting streak to 21 games with a 9th inning infield hit. Saturday. Chadwick struck out 4, walked 2, and departed after 114 pitches. "At 71 pitches after 3, I told him after the game I was betting on 4 innings for him," said Holm. "Somehow he ended up getting through 7. That was fantastic." Chadwick felt throwing his off-speed pitches for strikes was crucial when not slinging a mid-90s sinking fastball. "I have an above-average fastball for this conference," he said. "So the off-speed has given me a lot of success in being able to keep guys from sitting dead red on that fastball. That has been really big for me." Freshman Toby Schreier took over for Chadwick and protected a 4-2 ISU lead by retiring the Bears without incident in the 8th. The Redbirds tacked on 3 8th-inning runs on a 2-run Graham Mastro's triple and Stolga's run-scoring double. Schreifer took up a Stewart home run in the 9th before notching his 1st save. "When the game's on the line, you've got to stay loose and trust your stuff," said Schreifer. "I get 3 outs and then the guys put up a 3-spot. That takes a lot of stress off your shoulders." Friday. Dylan Robertson's 3-run double highlighted a 6-run Missouri State 8th inning as the Bears topped ISU 14-10. The Valley leaders sent 10 batters to the plate to transform a 9-8 deficit into a 14-9 lead. The Redbirds scored just once after pushing four fifth-inning runs for a 9-5 advantage. All four ISU tallies came with two outs as Daniel Contreras stroked a two-run single and Josh Outlaw lined a two-run double, both on 0-2 counts. Missouri State scored three times in the sixth to pull within 9-8. A solo homer from Josh Rodriguez started the Bears' huge eighth inning. It was home run derby in the first inning as both teams struck for two solo homers. Rodriguez and Jake McCutcheon cleared the wall for the Bears, and Robinson and Morris went deep for the Redbirds. Morris added a 427-foot solo shot in the fourth for his 15th round-tripper of the season. ISU starter Thomas Harper allowed five earned runs in the 4 2/3 inning, allowing five hits and walking five. Reliever Tresden Ryerbeck took the loss. Six Redbird pitchers combined to walk nine, five of which scored. Draft hopefuls. ISU has two players on the Baseball America rankings of top 400 prospects for the Major League Baseball draft. The list, which includes high school and college prospects, has Robinson listed at number 346 and Pichella at number 358. Editor's picks. The Chicago Cubs. Sullivan. The emergence of Cubs Pete Crow Armstrong is drawing attention from all around the game. Milwaukee. Let PCA be PCA is the narrative being tossed around as Pete Crow Armstrong has emerged this season as one of the game's best all-around titles. But what exactly does that mean? When I asked manager Craig Counsell before Sunday's 4-0 loss to the Milwaukee Brewers, he wasn't sure himself. "What are we supposed to tell Pete to stop doing?" he replied. "I don't know either." One marquee Sports Network personality interjected by saying, "Crow Armstrong ticked off other teams with his celebrations," but there's no real evidence that anyone has objected to his display of emotions. "I don't think he's done anything I would describe as showy," Counsell said. "There are things you can do that are showboating, but I don't think he's done anything of that nature." Crow Armstrong was quiet on Sunday as the Cubs' offense was shut down by Freddie Peralta and three Brewers relievers. The biggest concern was the possible loss of starter Shota Imanga, who carried a shutout in the sixth inning before being removed with a left hamstring injury while covering first base on a play. Imanga will get an MRI Monday before the Cubs decide whether to put him on the injured list. The Cubs finished the road trip with a 4-2 record in series wins in Pittsburgh and Milwaukee. "Today, obviously, we'd rather have put up more runs than none and win the game," Kyle Tucker said. "But we can't complain too much. We won the series, and you've got to take the good with the bad and move forward to the next series." Tucker incurred right hip pain during a ninth-inning slide, but insisted he'd be fine for Monday's game at Wrigley Field against the San Francisco Giants. Crow Armstrong went 1-for-3 Sunday after hitting three home runs in two Cub wins. He entered the game tied for second in the majors with a 2.2 FWAR and from April 13th through Saturday had more home runs, 9, RBI, 21, and extra base hits, 16, than any other player. It was 1 year ago this month that Crow Armstrong was demoted to AAA Iowa after hitting .236 with one home run and 9 RBI in his first 23 games of 2024. He was quickly brought back up, and the Cubs decided to let him learn at the major league level. What a difference a year makes. Crow Armstrong credited Counsell for allowing him to stay true to himself. "From the jump, that's been Counsell's MO for me," the 23-year-old said. "He never wanted me to do anything but be myself, and he's given me a chance to see how I fit in with this team over the last couple years. We all talked about it a lot last year, where I had a lot of opportunities to fail, and they gave me some good time to find my fitting." Counsell likes to point out that baseball is entertainment. He often likens it to a reality TV show, where some players are bigger characters than others, and he considers himself a flop as an entertainer. If that's the case, if the Cubs were like the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills of the baseball world, Crow Armstrong would be one of the housewives with top billing, on which everyone has an opinion. It's cool that he's got a pretty big personality, and he hasn't lost all that, starter Jameson Taillman said. Sometimes in the big leagues, that's discouraged. It's a testament to everyone in the club and the Cubs organization for letting him shine bright. Sometimes with younger guys, people want to tell them to stay quiet. I feel like we've done a good job of being like, nah, go ahead, be yourself. Go be a dude, be a star. And I think that helps. The Cubs open a three-game series Monday against the Giants, another National League West team, off to a strong start after the Cubs finished an opening month gauntlet that included an 11-9 record against the Los Angeles Dodgers, San Diego Padres, and Arizona Diamondbacks. Following an off day Thursday, the Cubs travel to New York to begin a three-game weekend series against the Mets, another elite team in the organization where Crow Armstrong started his career before being dealt to the Cubs in 2021 in the Javier Baez deal. Crow Armstrong recalled the time as a Mets prospect when he overslept on a day he was scheduled for a COVID-19 test and was called on the carpet by farm director Jared Banner, who is now an assistant general manager under Cubs GM Carter Hawkins. That was the best blessing in disguise because we obviously talked about it, Crow Armstrong said. We got to know each other from the jump. Everybody, all the way back to the Mets. I've felt pretty free, but especially here. The people have given me the green light to go be myself without question. I'm grateful for that because it's probably a different story if I'm being held back. The Cubs have had players over the years who've crossed the line and done or said things that weren't in the best interests of the team. Former pitcher Carlos Zambrano, who became a preacher after retirement, was constantly under the microscope for letting his emotions get the best of him. Counsel said if he saw Crow Armstrong do something that didn't make sense for the team, he would say something, as he's done in the past with players he's managed. But I haven't seen anything like that, he said. The Cubs have a veteran-infused clubhouse, and Crow Armstrong's teammates would also say something if needed. There are times when we all need to be reined in a little here and there, and if somebody can point something out and we all keep each other humble, Cubs shortstop Dansby Swanson said. This team loves to talk trash to one another. All the ways we hold each other accountable is a way to keep everyone in line, but also comfortable in their own skin. Few players are as comfortable in their own skin as PCA, and his sudden emergence in 2025 has the rest of baseball talking. Thunderbolts kicks off the summer movie season with $76 million at the box office. New York. Marvel Studios' Thunderbolts opened with $76 million in domestic ticket sales, according to studio estimates Sunday, kicking off the summer box office with a solid number one debut that fell shy of Marvel's more spectacular launches. All eyes were on whether Thunderbolts, a team-up of anti-hero rejects similar to Avengers, could restore the Walt Disney Company superhero factory to the kind of box office performance the studio once enjoyed so regularly. The results, similar to the debuts of The Eternals at $71 million and Ant-Man and the Wasp at $75 million, suggested Marvel's malaise won't be easy to snap out of. Some expected a bigger opening for Thunderbolts because of the film's good word of mouth. Unlike most recent MCU entries, reviews, 88% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, have been excellent for Thunderbolts. Directed by Jake Schreier and starring Florence Pugh, David Harbour, and Sebastian Stan, audiences gave it an A-minus score on CinemaScore. That kind of response should power the movie to strong business in the coming weeks, though bigger MCU films, including 2024's Deadpool vs. Wolverine, with a $211 million opening on the way to $1.34 billion worldwide, have monopolized movie screens immediately. Thunderbolts could gather steam more steadily, or it could go down as another example of Marvel struggling to rekindle its golden touch. Marvel spent about $180 million to produce the movie, which added $86.1 million in overseas sales. The film also teases the next MCU chapter, The Fantastic Four: First Steps, due out July 25th. Marvel set the bar so high for so many years that a $76 million opening may seem to some like it should have done $100 million or something like that, said Paul DeGarbadian, senior media analyst for ComScore. This is a great reset. They're hitting the reset with Thunderbolts, the great reviews, and the word of mouth should hold it in good stead. The Walt Disney Company also might not have expected such stout competition from Ryan Coogler's Sinners. The Warner Brothers release, which had led the box office the last 2 weeks, continued to hold remarkably well. In its third week, it grossed $33 million, a dip of only 28%. Sinners, a 1932 set vampire movie about bootlegging brothers, both played by Michael B. Jordan, who open a juke joint in their Mississippi hometown, has proven a spring sensation in theaters. It has collected $179.7 million domestically and $236.7 million globally thus far. Warner Brothers also nabbed third place with a Minecraft movie, the smash hit video game adaptation. In its fifth weekend, it rung up another $13.7 million to bring its North American gross to nearly $400 million. Worldwide, it has totaled $873.4 million. Warner Brothers added Block Party Edition screenings over the weekend for a sing-along and meme-along experience. The film has seen some rowdy screenings from TikTok-inspired moviegoers. More than 3 years after cinematographer Helena Hutchins was killed on set, the Alec Baldwin Western Rust arrived in theaters. Its release brought some closure to one of Hollywood's greatest tragedies. Distributor Falling Forward Films didn't report box office, but estimates suggest Rust grossed approximately $25,000 in 115 theaters. Following Hutchins' death, the film's armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, was sentenced to prison for involuntary manslaughter. First Assistant Director David Halls was sentenced to probation after pleading no contest to negligent use of a deadly weapon. Involuntary manslaughter charges against Baldwin, a co-producer on the film, were twice dismissed in 2023 and again in 2024. As part of a wrongful death settlement, Matt Hutchins, Hutchins' husband, was made an executive producer on the film. This has been Hannah with the Pantograph from May 6th, 2025. I hope you have a lovely rest of your day.